welcome to Unboxing, play and profit for the gaming curious. I'm Lane Nooney.
I'm Joost van Drenen.
And we are here digging deep on why games matter in today's economy. On the docket today for Friday, December 16th, 2022, last week the FTC announced it's going after Microsoft over its proposed acquisition of Activision Blizzard. What's it mean? Does it matter? And what does the FTC do anyway? We're going to talk to the smartest guy in the game industry, our very own Joost, to get to the bottom of it. And besides that top shelf news, we've got lots of other fun stuff today. We'll be chatting about the Game Awards, some game industry related travels we've been having and talks we've been giving, all that and more with your two seasonal co-hosts. But first, we've got some catching up to do. Joost,
you've been gone.
I've been gone. You've been gone. We didn't. And finally, last week, it was your turn to be the reason we didn't have an episode. After I was the reason we didn't go for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Joost, I heard a little birdie told me that you got bird flu, and yes. Maybe I'm dumb, but I don't really know what that is. How did a grown man get bird flu? What's bird flu?
It's my euphemism for being. You know how men, when they get sick, they're like extra sick. So I can't just say, oh, I'm feeling tired and under the weather. It's like I have to like dramatize.
You need an exotic disease. My
medical circumstance. So that's hence a bird flu. I can assure you that I wailed incessantly and, you know, was so weak and feeble. And so it re-triggered my entire midlife crisis. I thought I was past it, but here I am again. So it's all salads and, you know, plank positions from now on. So I think I've worked too hard. That's the short of it. It's like I get sick in the winter once a year and I worked too hard and then I got sick and I was out for like 4 days. But I'm back full of words. So let's go. You were gone. You weren't even there to like nurse me back to health. So
I mean, I have a question. Is bird flu meaningfully different from the regular flu?
Bird flu was a flu not too long ago. It was avian influenza.
Right? Avian influenza.
Yeah, and it was like a big thing where you couldn't travel or you had to like do this whole thing a few years ago where it's like, okay.
Were you feeding pigeons in the park again?
In fact, no, I was not doing any of that. But that's probably a good place to get it.
You didn't get it from a bird. It doesn't have any other extreme like extra symptoms. It's just a version of the flu. That's what I'm getting.
Yeah, it was a pretty bad thing like a few years ago, according to the CDC at least. But it's basically just like a really shitty thing to have.
Okay.
Like foot and mouth kind of thing.
Sure. So I am totally COVID recovered. No long-term symptoms, no long COVID, nothing like that. Thank God. So I was out the beginning of December because I was over at the University of Utah. We'll talk about that. Lately, I've just been my busyness for the week. I'm just preparing for my Christmas party, you know? I've just been spending like 3 hours decorating cookies every night. It's exhausting.
You're so domestic. I love it.
I've got a to-do item later today to pick up my ham. So like
it's just like it seems to me that this whole like hipster affront is just a re-domestication of a generation. That just doesn't want to be seen in aprons. But it's like, no, I have tattoos now. And so it's like cool baking. And it's like, as opposed to I'm just like my mother.
It's ironic baking, right? It's like it's I'm ironic gonna baking. Ironic decorating, ironic baking.
Oh, all right, enough about it.
So some of the news updates. Game Awards happened last week. Did you watch?
I watched some of it. I find them generally tedious to watch this. As much as I support it, I do find it sort of like, I don't care for these self-celebratory events. So the thing about the Game Awards, where I always come in, is like, I had a guest speaker from Rockstar years ago, actually not that many years ago, come in and say like, look, there is no red carpet event for the person who made the helicopter in GTA fly really naturally, like make it seem sort of like a thing. Whereas in every other creative industry that it does exist, here's the lighting award, here's the costume design award. And so there should be recognition of talent in that sense, but we don't have Taylor Swift's and Brad Pitt's to stomp around. Like there's nothing to see That's visually interesting. And so the Video Game Awards, I think, are an attempt at that. I think Jeff Keighley has done a really good job doing that. And I think it's good to have that recognition and to celebrate people for their hard work. You know, and yet, just give me the shortlist, right? So, like, just give me the top 10 and, like, let's move on. But it's a very ceremonial thing, and I support it, but I don't find it particularly stimulating. Did you watch it?
I'm not sure I've ever watched it. I go and look at them afterwards, and I kind of reviewed all of the winners. I feel like, you know, I can't tell you the last time I watched the Oscars or the Emmys, or, right, this is a genre of, I guess, not television, but spectacle is not super interesting to me. I could imagine it as a kind of background noise. I also just have a general allergy to the kind of whiz-bangery of games, you know, like it's so extreme. I feel like the last time I tried to watch something like the Game Awards, that's what it felt like. It felt like I was chugging several Red Bulls and I just had to step back, you know, I needed some room. Like, but a thing I didn't know, so I was doing a little digging into the Game Awards. I didn't realize that, you know, between 2016 and 2020, the viewership has doubled nearly every year. From, you know, 2016, it was a little under 3 million. By 2021, 85 million. So that's a pretty remarkable curve. I mean, a bunch of that obviously is live streaming, global live streams, but I was pretty impressed with those metrics, at least. He is watching this, or at least turning it on and then leaving the room. So, you know.
Yeah, 85 million people is a lot of people.
Yeah, for the general highlights of the Game Awards, the big name awards, right, the awards that you can kind of always predict are going to go to the AAAs, were mostly split this year between Elden Ring and God of War Ragnarok. Elden Ring took Game of the Year, hard to dispute that. As well as best game direction, best art direction, while Ragnarok got best narrative, best score, best audio design. So those are really the two big standouts for AAAs of the year. I looked at the other games on the list, and some of them I was like, I'm not even sure what you are. You know, are you? I played Elden Ring at the beginning of the year. Certainly did not finish it, but I definitely get the mystique. I'm not a God of War fan. Are you a Ragnarok? Are you a God? You're the ideal. You are a middle-aged dad, right?
Are you kidding me?
Ideal audience for Ragnarok.
And before my middle age and dadness, I was already a fan of that too. Because, you know, the thing is with like a God of War, it's like sort of in typical Sony fashion. It is spectacular. I mean, you know, it was like the second God of War. I forget what it's called. Like the first level of that is immediately into this massive boss battle where you just swing it around with your like chain swords. Like trying to slice and dice, all they're just massive monster. And it sets the tone for, you know, 20 or 40 hours of that gameplay. Super fun. I really like the hack and slash components. And of course, they added a bunch more depth to the characters with, like, you know, Dead of War when he gets to the boy, that whole thing. So I'm a fan of the franchise because how could you fucking not? Like, if you like film, like, of course, you like the major franchises. It's just a major franchise. It's established itself. They've done a really good job fleshing out that character. I don't have some, like, secret fantasy of wanting to become some, like, gray, bluish, giant, muscular, demigod slashing people as a living, you know. That sort of male fantasies are like, yeah, I get it. Like, especially in the early ones, there's a lot of nudity. It's like, okay, that's cool. I part ways with some of that purely because it doesn't really serve any narrative other than like appealing
nudity,
to the same demographic.
Nudity has to serve the narrative. Yeah.
No, that's what I'm saying. It's like, just like, it wasn't done well enough to be like facetious. It's like, okay, let's just go all the way.
Yeah. And
it
was, early Witcher stuff, you know?
Exactly. Like, it's sort of like, all right, so for now, me then,
the nudity.
Where I've arrived as a person, as a player, perhaps, is like my heart goes more to like Plague's Tale, right? Where I am trying to navigate this environment that is incredibly hostile, and I have to also I have this like dumbass and toy, you know, that I have to take with me because my little kid brother is like sensitive to everything. And, oh my god, he's constantly running off because he's 5 or 8 or whatever. And it's like, so, but that is a much more interesting one. Whereas, you know, that's a deviation from, say, Assassin's Creed, where I get to stab everybody. Literally, some of the more recent versions of Assassin's Creed, like your enemies will stand in a circle around you, taking turns getting murdered by you. It's just like the game mechanically, there's like, I think that's fantastically satisfying. And also, that's not really, you know, all that. So, Plague's Tale, Requiem, I just started it. I'm a few hours in. It's beautiful. I feel vulnerable the entire time. Like I'm about to die. Same as Hellblade. you know, where you are basically a vulnerable protagonist, whereas God of War does not offer me that. Elden Ring, you're kind of vulnerable the whole time because it's just like, you know,
I mean, yeah, it's that, that environment is designed to kill you at every turn, right?
Right.
I mean, stupid death is like the label of Elden Ring.
Stupid death. So I'm hoping next year there'll be more like vulnerable protagonists that are winning stuff.
More games for vulnerable men. Okay.
You know, I have feelings. I want to express them. I want to get them out of me. Right. I want to share it. I have so much love to give. Okay.
Of course, obviously the AAAs are not all the Game Awards have to offer. We get kind of game unique categories like best ongoing game that went to Final Fantasy 14. Marvel Snap rose to the top real fast to take best mobile game. Pretty impressive for a game that was released in October, beating out Apex Legends, Genshin Impact, though Genshin did take the Player Choice Award, which based on student approval, I think feels accurate. And Annapurna Stray took best indie, being defined as, quote, a game made outside the traditional publisher system, whatever that means, right? I think with Annapurna, we're definitely talking about III production, right? And certainly for some wings of indie, I think showing up in the best indie category of the Game Awards is the least indie thing you could do. But, you know, Stray is just another one of these kind of maybe comparably smaller budget games with really high production value that's kind of boutique-y and maybe a bit designed, right, for these sorts of categories.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's beautiful. $20 for 5 hours of gameplay. From a financial standpoint, also very pretty. But, you know, I just think it's a pandering to people that like cats. You know, like it's just like the
offensive.
Digital. I just like at the second, whatever device or application I have open, and like at the second, like cat pictures start showing up, it's like I'm out. It's not that I dislike cats, it's like enough already with the cats. So it's kind of, that's why it's a little lower on my list. But, you know, I think you're right. It's like you have to, I guess, to your point for Stray as well as for Marvel Snap, it's like big titles just draw more attention. They have better marketing machines. And so, you know,
I mean,
they reach
yeah,
more people.
Annapurna was able to put an obvious publicity team behind Stray, right? I mean, that game was everywhere for, you know, a couple weeks, getting covered in newspapers and all sorts of stuff, just because it's like, it's just another game. Like, you know, hundreds of these get released every year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm with you. We'll have to see. Like, I mean, it's you can't expect the Oscars or the Grammys or the Emmys to start celebrating, you know, your student film. And I don't think that's the same. I think it's the same for the video games awards. Like,
yeah, do we need a Sundance of video games? Maybe that was once maybe IndieCade or something, but I'm not sure it fulfills that role anymore.
Yeah, that's a good one. There should be like, you know, there should be a peer review or some kind of, I mean, there naturally will be. I mean, the Game Awards are a manifestation of the fact that the games industry is reaching many more people, much more money is going around. And so it needs to calcify a little bit and have these award shows so that they can put the sticker on the box and off they go, right?
Yep.
And good for them. But then naturally we'll also have sideshows like the ones that you mentioned. So I think it's a matter of time. I wonder, when will we have the Crypto Game Awards? When does that happen?
The FTX Award for, you know?
Yeah, the FTX sponsors these nominees.
The Sam Bankman-Fried Cultural Achievement Awards.
Sam Bankman-Fried, the SBF Lifetime Achievement Award.
All right, yeah, now let's talk about anything else besides crypto. Yost, what's been going on with you? We have both had some industry-related hijinks. You had someone come into your class recently?
Yes, I had Niantic show up.
God damn. The power this man has.
They're just wielding it freely. And nothing but the best of my students. Yeah, it's someone that I've met while she was still at, she was doing basically publisher relationships there, and then eventually jumped, as is sort of typical in a in those roles where you have, like, when you work with lots of creative firms, it's like an aggregator of sorts, like a cable company. You know, you find one that you really like. They say, you know, a lot of people, come work for us. And I think that was roughly, as she described her own background. And now, of course, the big question on the board is, how does Niantic, after the success of Pokemon Go, reinvent itself? So they issued a few things over the years, over the last year. Do they make available their data and all of their technology by way of, I think it's called the Lighthouse? And it's a really interesting question strategically. And she was very forthcoming. Her name is Sarah Galarski. She's been there for a while. So like, okay, how do we make this data work for Niantic? And how do we make it work for game companies and people that wanna what they themselves call build the real metaverse, right? Which I have some thoughts about that term, but I think it's an interesting one to kind of stay with the times. You know, unlike a fully synthetic environment, they are proposing like use this real world data, this actual in-person, you know, overlay of technology and make experiences with that, right? And of course, with Pokemon Go, we know how that goes, but what else can you build with that? And so we kind of heard from and quizzed her on all of these things, like how does that sit? And I think it went over pretty well. The students seemed to take to it. Of course, everybody knows Pokemon Go, and she shared a few things that I can't share here, but it's clear that they're trying to solve the problem of like, where do we go next, right? Like, what's the next logical creative step? And it's a huge opportunity because I think there's a lot of data out there. Like Niantic has done a good job aggregating all this world data, this map-based data. At the same time, it's like, well, there's not a lot of creatives stepping into the space. So
yeah,
a buddy of mine started something called Living Cities, where they tried to sort of do that, where they sort of overlay of the real world and like some synthetic world and things correspond between them. If you do something here, it sort of shows up there and vice versa. So it's coming, but you know, you have to ask like, how far along in that transition are we where our digital and physical lives are related, intertwined, connected, causally related, as opposed to two separate realms? And I think that's a really interesting intersection for business.
I mean, of all the companies, Niantic is probably best positioned to work on that problem because they have actually practically and successfully been doing it for such a long time now. You know, it would seem that they have the sort of incumbent advantage.
It's really a pioneering company, right? It's if the fans will know that before Pokemon Go, it was called Ingress,
yep,
which is basically the same game. It's sort of territorial fiefdoms. And it's interesting for a lot of reasons, you know, if not the least that it's, you know, reskinning it with Pokemon IP all of a sudden allowed it to have this massive success. So game mechanically it didn't really change, but it was really about like the accessibility to the audience and sort of being able to plug into that. So speaking of discovering new places, you went to Utah.
Yeah, and not just as a pass-through to get on a different plane. So I actually got off the plane in Salt Lake City and spent a couple nights there. I was invited out as a guest speaker for the EAE program, that's Entertainment Arts and Engineering at the University of Utah. Mm. And so I got to, it's not a program that was like big on my radar. I knew that there was something going on at Utah. Utah also has a phenomenal history in terms of the pioneering role it played in the development of computer graphics back in the 60s and 70s. But yeah, I didn't, you know, I was invited out by one of their faculty members, Jose Zagal. And it was very cool. This is most of my exposure to undergrad or master's level programs that train students for game production comes through Game Center, right, at NYU. And that's a very different kind of shop than these are kids being trained to enter into AAA pipelines. And it was super interesting to me in that regard. So they're taught to work on really big teams. You know, there's several hundred students at the, you know, between the undergrad and the MA level. And it's, you know, it's housed in an engineering school, but the faculty are really creatively and intellectually diverse. They've got philosophers, engineers, you know, people who do game studies, people who just focus on game arts practices. Really cool program that I was happy to learn more about. And they've only been around for like 10 years, but have been super successful, it seems, in terms of their placement rates.
What did you tell them all about? Like, what was your talk?
It's a talk I have about the history of the game engine, which I told through the role of the game engine at Sierra Online. So the basic pitch for this is that we think of the game engine as a thing that was invented by id Software in the development of Doom, right? That's like, if you go to game history texts, everyone says that's where the game engine comes from. That's not true. The game engine was actually invented almost 10 years earlier by Sierra Online, or the thing that we would recognize as a game engine, which is basically a suite of software that separates the asset from the code base, right? And that was what was known as Sierra's Adventure Game Interpreter. It was the development system that they built to create King's Quest, and then became the sort of template for game creation at Sierra, basically for the next 10 years. That whole company's business, that I think it was so fascinating to finally figure out. And this was all work I kind of originally done for my dissertation, is that the engine really allowed for the mass production of games. They could sort of plug in a designer who didn't really know much about programming, and they could take these basic template files that were set up by more serious engineers at the company, and then kind of copy and paste them and change some of the details to make something like a game. And so big part of this history is about the de-skilling of game programming. That's also not a narrative you get out of the Doom story. The Doom engine story is all about the open access that it gave and the way that it allowed people to do modding and hacking of the game. And at Sierra, the engine was a proprietary system. And that's actually the norm for what game engines are, right? That it reveals something about the labor conditions under which these workers were operating that I think is super fun. And yeah, goes back to, you know, really far into the origins of the industry. And then I have a little shtick in there also about the game engine worked in a very specific spatialized way that you really, once you understand how the game engine works, you can see that they designed a whole lot of their puzzles around the game engine. So the game engine wound up being one of the drivers of puzzle design at Sierra, and really explains a lot of the puzzles that fans, at least of Sierra, would recognize as some of their oddest or most unusual or most difficult puzzles, you know, were actually puzzles that came out of the limitations of the game engine.
Huh. That's fascinating. I like it when designers are forced, or developers are forced to like come up with stuff out of scarcity or limitations.
Or in some cases, lack of creativity. I think we could also make the argument.
I'm just trying to be nice. You know, yeah. I have so much against me already. It's like, I don't need to piss off more people. But it's, you know, my go-to in that sort of, like, it's a more neutered example, but it's like the Mario looks the way he does because they only had two colors and only a few squares. And so they had to figure, like, you know, that's why his overalls, because like a shirt and pants look terrible. And so he gave him overalls, and they gave him gloves and a mustache. So just to kind of give a little bit of design on this character. Otherwise, it's just like this nameless, shapeless little dude. It makes for better design to have these limitations. It's like, it's always fascinating to me. It's like, yeah, you only have so much time. And I guess you could flesh it out in a big way with regards to like writing. You have only an hour to write 500 words, or you only have like whatever, this much money to shoot a film. It's like, limits are key to that. And game engines, I think, in the same way. So it's a refreshing counter narrative to like everything always getting bigger, faster, stronger, more processing power across the world. It's like, yeah, that's not necessarily the only way to make great things, right? It's actually the opposite sometimes, limiting yourself that really tends to really spur that. That's fascinating. Can we do a whole game engine talk sometime? Can we do an episode?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the nice things about using Sierra as the history here is the model here is that because all of their designers basically had to, this was the core technology at Sierra. This was the factory line. You can see how different designers implemented it. And you can actually, I think, see a real range of skill in terms of design finesse between the designers who were really good at thinking about what is the function of gameplay to designers who kind of tended to play whack-a-mole in terms of coming up with puzzles, where the design of puzzles was really just to put a series of gates between the player and the end, versus designers, you know, I think a lot of like, you know, Christy Marks or Jane Jensen or Laurie and Corey Cole as being really adept designers who are good at thinking about what is the function of a puzzle. And then you get games like Leisure Suit Larry, or I think a lot of the King's Quest, where the puzzles are just intended to be obstacles, right? They're literally just a gate or a door that you have to kind of brute force open, right? Because the game design thinking was not particularly strong, I think, in a lot of those games.
Ken sent me. Yeah, that's totally true. That's how I learned English, is I was playing Leisure Suit Larry and I had to learn how to say short phrases to like open the door and hail a taxi and figure out how to like, you know, do whatever that game was requiring of me as a 9-year-old. But it was a, it's a fascinating thing because I, of course, I've always known that the aesthetic between those games is very similar. The way it sort of walks and it talks and it moves, it gets better. But I think it's a, you know, it's something that later on I would see, for instance, in like a Take Two, where they have, you know, they have like Manhunt, where you have this targeting system, which then of course shows up in the next Grand Theft Auto afterwards because they perfected it. And then you have Max Payne, and they have this aiming system and a sort of, you know, firefight mechanic. And then that shows up. So they start accumulating all these components to the engine that they build internally. And it really become, that's the business, right? The game engine is the business.
Yes.
Of gaming. So
I mean, that's Skyrim and Fallout, right? It's mm-hmm. that, you know, the way the game engine economizes and standardizes game production is an undertold component of this, and the way that it really sets the conditions of labor, right? Part of my argument is also that the game engine is what creates a labor flow, and it thus kind of allows for different levels of engineering expertise and artistic expertise to emerge, because you figure out, where can we economize on certain processes? How do we keep chunking this work into the lowest level so that we can give it to the least trained person and therefore mm-hmm. spend the least amount of money on paying a person to do this particular kind of work, right? That's all sort of built in to how the game engine workflow pipeline functions.
That's fascinating. All right, so that will be to come, a special episode on Lane.
On the game engine.
And the history of the game engine.
Now time for our most hotly awaited topic. So we made a decision not to talk about this the very second it happened last week while you were sick with the bird flu, thinking giving it a little distance would be good. So the top line headline here is that the FTC is suing Microsoft. Is that my understanding? Do I have that correct?
They filed a formal complaint, yes.
They filed a formal complaint that they are taking Microsoft to task for its attempted acquisition of Activision Blizzard. Microsoft is having a real hard time. Yost, give us the kind of top headlines of this, and then we can break this down in more detail.
Okay, so the part that most people know is that this acquisition was announced in January. Microsoft wants to build its, you know, market position in existing and new markets. And the size of the deal, and of course, the visibility of Activision being involved, makes it so that everybody has a goddamn opinion about this thing. And so do antitrust regulators, right? People have been waiting to see what the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, has to say about this. We've also heard from the CMA in this podcast and in general a few times. And then there's also the European Committee. So the things to know are, here's a big transaction, and then it really boils down to three regulators out there that are busy themselves to kind of figure this out. And then there is a bunch of companies that have something to say. It kind of varies. You know, Take Two has said publicly, we really care, have at it. Sony obviously says this is bad for everyone. And so you can kind of see how opinions are divided. And then there's a larger narrative behind it with regards to, like, okay, should large tech companies have an opportunity to basically use all of those big dollar transactions to secure a future for themselves and in the process become monopolists or create some anti-competitive market situation? So that's sort of the soup in which all of this crumbles. The FTC then filed on December 8th. A formal complaint, a 23-page long document that says, here's why we think this is bad and it's important for consumers, right? The emphasis and focus of antitrust regulators is never like, is it nice? Will it have like a cool logo? It's always what's going to happen to consumers, meaning prices, access, da-da-da-da, right? Are you locked in? And so
they're theoretically supposed to be on our side, right? Making sure that corporations don't screw us over by trying to achieve, right, the biggest company, the best share price, et cetera.
Right. So the underbelly of all that is that, of course, big tech has been the big bad wolf, and demonstrably so. They've been across the board, either lackadaisical or deliberately sharing data in a way that they shouldn't have been, or collecting and aggregating data in a way that's totally inappropriate. But here we are. And so that is naturally called into action a lot of regulators and governments around the world. And so really what's happened with the Biden administration has, that's notable here for the FTC, is the appointment of Lina Khan as its, you know, chief commissioner. Lina Khan is a legal scholar who has been writing about platform economies and how to shape and reshape legal policy around it for years. Yeah. An absolutely brilliant writer. If you're into that kind of stuff, like go read like The Antitrust Paradox, which is on Amazon. It just lays it open. It like takes a fish knife and it just opens the belly of that whole thing. And it's just like, it's fascinating to see. Like, yes, it is true that these companies will use their market power in one part of the industry, one part of their platform economy, and use it to subsidize another one so that they can capture and lock customers in some kind of way. So effectively rewriting a lot of the policies around how to regulate big tech industries, you know, entertainment industries and so on. They've sued Meta, as we're talking about it now. They're in court with Meta for this VR acquisition.
Yeah,
which is really
very, like a very small ball though, right?
Well, but that's the that goes to the principle of it. It's like they don't want any big tech publisher to a tech company to have an immediate stranglehold on a nascent industry, right? So the example, the textbook was like Instagram, where they could just buy it out and that was the end of it, right? No one else had a chance to be in there anymore until other competitors in different categories showed up. But really, Facebook at the time managed to position itself by just leveraging its power. They're afraid that the Meta complex is going to basically figure out how to dominate the VR fitness category, which is, of course, a contentious point because there's other VR fitness category and it's very small, but that's sort of the thinking.
Let me ask you a bigger scale question. You know, how much of what's going on right now is, do we think the FTC needing to beat a big drum, and this is the first big thing to come underway, and how much of this is actually about Microsoft and Activision, right? Like, why isn't this Amazon? Why isn't this Apple? Is it just because they haven't stepped in it in a big enough way that the FTC can actually do something? Is Microsoft just an opportunistic target, or is there really something that we should be concerned here about?
That's the answer is both, right? So in the terms of the document, first and foremost, post acquisition, Microsoft will be in a position and will have the incentive to foreclose its rivals, meaning creating a situation where Sony will be totally boxed out. They could totally do that because they would own it and they would say, Sony, it's been nice knowing you. We'll see you later, right? And that should be a concern.
What would that happening look like?
They would just no longer offer Call of Duty, for instance, on the PlayStation platform, which is a big deal title across the board, but specifically for Sony, of course, like that's where your multiplayer, your shooters, that's the classic audience for console gaming. That would be a concern. And Sony's right to point that out, say like, yep, that's a problem. And it is a problem. They could. And so both the CMA and the FTC have said they have the ability and the incentive to foreclose. Now, you know, as serious as we should take that, you know, the key argument that a lot of people have put forward with ZeniMax saying like, oh, first they said that they would not do it and then they did it, so therefore they can't be trusted. That's the argument that now sort of floats a lot of what's being said about this proposed acquisition.
Why would we believe a tech company, right? Like their statements are not binding. So, you know.
It's actually not true that they did that. You know, it's like it was a ZeniMax transaction, you know, that it would not, according to the EU at least, raise any competition concerns. And so therefore they're like, okay, cool, we can do this, right? So it's not a one-for-one comparison. Just because, you know, Microsoft said one thing and then whatever went the other way, and I'm not championing them here. It's like they're grown people, they can do their own thing. But, you know, from a legal standpoint, which is what this video is about, and from, you know, from what's measured and being evidenced, that didn't impact at all according to the EU. So therefore they could do that, and they did, and that's fine. So it's not a fair comparison to take the ZeniMax incident and say, oh, therefore we can't trust all of Microsoft. Like, that's not a defensible position. Anyway, so, but nevertheless, it needs to be scrutinized. It deserves to be scrutinized because consumers and creatives, particularly in my mind, stand to lose from this. And so what the FTC has done, in effect, is basically laid out four major complaints saying it needs to, you know, not do these things. Or it says, basically by saying it could do these things, it's saying if somehow Microsoft could issue a consent decree, meaning we're not going to do this, it's a legally binding agreement that it would put in front of the judge, because by filing the complaint, the FTC has no, it's not judge and juror at the same time, right? So they make the complaint, but then it goes to the administrative judge, and they actually file ultimately on this. if Microsoft adds a consent decree and says, we promise not to do this, and it's legally binding for these 4 points brought forward by the FTC, then it should be free and clear. That's sort of the expectation that I have. That's the expectation that Wall Street seems to have, and a lot of people I talk to. So it's you know, one analyst called Michael Pachter, he called it like, it's a roadmap, right? It's like, just do these four things. It's a quest, you know, just get these four items and then we can make your magical sword. So that's the one side of it. The other side, of course, and that speaks to your point of like, is this politically motivated, which is what you're really asking. And I think that there is some the extent to that, right? There is a new administration. It's a large transaction. You have to be heard. You have to be in the mix, because what kind of watchdog are you if such a massive controversial transaction is about to take place and you are saying nothing, issuing nothing, filing nothing? So they did, right? And sort of in typical fashion, as you would expect, of the four commissioners, three Democrat, one Republican, only the Republican voted in favor. So they did it and they filed the complaint, which is sort of, you know, party lines and all that. But the FTC also filed 3 months earlier than people expected. And I think that has a lot to do with a larger ecosystem of antitrust, this ecosystem of the FTC, the CMA, and the EU. Because those are the three major ones and relevant ones, you know, other countries have issued in favor or against it, you know, and nobody has really taken notice. It's really these three. The FTC does not want to be in a position where the CMA issues first and then it has to backtrack on its own company, you know, a company in its own country, say like, oh, here's the UK. The EU has been running tests in the market that are what they call behavioral remedies, kind of like, can we figure this out? And that seems to ultimately be okay in the long term. The CMA has a history of going to phase one really like a stick and with like fire and brimstone and then kind of coming out like, oh, it's more puppies and chocolates. So they tend to kind of dull their blade, but they too have needs to be politically visible, because post-Brexit, like, who cares about England? Well, let's make them care. So they've been issuing a lot. They've been hiring a lot of people, from what I told. They've also started an investigation into Google and mobile with regards to browser-based gaming and cloud gaming, saying like, this is a duopoly, like, what the hell? So everybody's kind of like at the front of the seat trying to be heard. And I think that, to your point, is a big part of this decision as well.
So what is your over-under on the likelihood that Microsoft is going to get boxed into issuing a consent decree?
Oh, that's happening, and the deal
It's already baked?
It's not baked. They're working on it. I mean, this just came out. So they got, you know, they have a lot of phone calls, a lot of meetings, but it'll be a few weeks and then they'll just say like, yep, we'll agree to all this. And then thank you very much. Let's close the deal and off they go.
And so what happens is they do the consent decree. And then what happens to this complaint? Does it go away? Does it get revoked? Like,
Oh no. So the complaint is XYZ. And then the judge goes, well, they just legally committed themselves to not doing XYZ. Therefore, this is moot and we're going to dismiss. And that's the end of that.
Is that bad for Lena Khan if it gets dismissed? Or is that
that's good for Lena Khan. I mean, it's, you know, I don't think that there's enough here to go on, because if you look through the definitions, it's like, it's really about the relationship between Microsoft and Sony. Like, it doesn't really touch on other categories that are relevant. It doesn't talk about backbone infrastructure and cloud gaming. It doesn't really go into mobile very deeply.
I was going to say, the thing we've been underscoring, right, is that Activision Blizzard, huge chunk of their revenue is not wrapped up in Call of Duty. It's wrapped up in King. This is what it keeps getting overlooked in these conversations.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, it would, and that's part. So I told you a few weeks ago, I was going to synthesize and write it down. I did. I submitted it to both the FTC and the CMA, my sort of like, whatever, 20 pages. And it comes down to a few different pro-competitive arguments. And one of them is Apple and Google are totally unimpressed by Activision Blizzards. I've met with Activision Blizzard in the past. They're like, oh, this company sucks, because as a platform, they don't care about gaming like other platforms conventionally do. And so, in other words, the negotiation position, even of a large publisher like Activision Blizzard, is relatively limited in a mobile ecosystem. Now, if that, instead of Activision, is Microsoft, that changes dramatically how that relationship takes place. And I think that is pro-competitive. I think that is good for consumers. There will be alternative payment methods. There will be different pricing, blah, 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 blah. So that's just one argument where you say, like, this is a bigger deal company that can have a bigger deal impact on a mobile ecosystem, for instance.
So interesting. I listened to the Pivot episode about the FTC going after Microsoft. I was so... I was so hungry to see, oh, what are Kara Swisher and Scott Calloway going to make of this? And it was, there's a few opinions they had that I wanted to kind of throw at you. Also, it was generally a disappointing conversation. You had to listen to 30 minutes of them bullshitting to get to, I think 4 minutes of conversation was what they devoted to this. And it was very clear that they were in over their heads on talking about the game industry. One of the points that Kara Swisher kept falling back on was that that trying to mess with this acquisition is good for China and Japan, that this somehow pushes out the competitive force of Microsoft globally, and that we are just doing a favor to China and Japan. Do you find any credence in that sort of argument?
Look, it is true that it would be... So it's true that Tencent has been moving more aggressively globally because domestically it's having a lot of problems, right? Kids under 18 don't get to play more than 3 hours a week. Things are expensive. The regulators there are pain in the neck. So they're like, you know what?
And of course, a general history of reverse FDI. Yeah.
Right. And so by moving internationally and building out their global presence, they de-risk their whole business. And so that means buying up bits and pieces of Ubisoft and setting up studios in North America and so on. So that will be a much harder to regulate company for governments in the US and the UK and everywhere else than it is companies that are actually from there, right? So in that sense, incentivizing or not throwing a lot of sand in the engine of Microsoft in this case will help fortify the domestic positions. So, you're going to end up with large global powers anyways. And so, who's going to be the top one in your country? Already, is Tencent vastly larger than everybody else. So even post-acquisition, Microsoft will be $25 billion. It's still $8 billion smaller than Tencent based on 2021 revenue. So, you can say, well, that's probably not exactly what you want. Like, if we don't like TikTok, in other words, and we're moving to, get that out of the app stores in North America, then, why would we have Tencent be the dominant game company? Like, would you have a dominant film production company in North America and Europe? Would you have a dominant music company? Maybe, probably not. But so there's an argument there. However, I thought about that. I think that that's also a little short-sighted. Like, it gets into murky territory with regards to, like, who gets to control cultural industries? And like, okay, I grew up in a small country, but like, look, we had Dutch TV, but most of what you're watching is like American made or French or German stuff because they export a lot of things too. So is that so bad to have like a foreign entity like make content for your consumer base? The Chinese seem to think so because you are necessarily paired up with a local partner. But so is that where we're headed with this?
Yeah,
so
that's China, a really China won't point. Allow it in the reverse, right? Right. They're happy to fund, to be underwriting American or Western consumption, but they do not want it operating in the other direction. Right.
So is that that's a murky territory, and I don't know necessarily letting them do this or by preventing Activision being acquired, that totally plays into the hands of China. Like, I think that that's a little strong, because we haven't seen it play out like that.
Yeah, so let me ask you, based on what I'm hearing from you, it seems like the risk that this isn't going to happen or that the FTC is somehow going to shut this down doesn't seem plausible. It seems that Microsoft is going to cross its T's and dot its I's on the consent decree. It's going to promise that anyone who wants to can access Call of Duty, and then we're all going to just wipe our hands and this is going to go away.
Well, let me ask you a question. Like, so where do you sit with this? What's your take? Like, is this bad? Is this like big tech getting more stuff, more toys, and won't share? Or is this, is there some other way to think about this? Like,
I mean, that's a good question. I am far less versed in this sort of antitrust kind of large scale competition. I will say I have a hard time getting stressed out by the idea that somebody doesn't have access to Call of Duty. Like, I just couldn't care less, right? I understand the strength of that game in the market. I still think the fixation on it just feels a bit silly. Like, what this is going to do is, it would seem like, is force some real competitive behavior out of Sony, right? I don't really know where Nintendo is in all of this. Nintendo has always sort of it's not been playing the same game as the other two in some really important ways, right? What is the danger of Microsoft vertically integrating one of the biggest, but also in some senses laziest publishers we have? How significant of a risk is that? I think I think I have a hard time understanding the premise on which we make that kind of argument. Like, I would rather us target Amazon or Apple or companies that I actually think are toxic and pernicious, which is not to say that Microsoft is not, but the idea of a gaming monopoly, I guess I struggle to care, I think is my problem. And that probably, I think I struggle to say that because it sounds like a really undereducated opinion. But I look at this and I just sort of blank and I'm like, Jesus, who gives a fuck? We are not talking about essential goods and services here.
Aren't we though? That's where I will disagree with you.
Not compared to something like Amazon, you know?
No, okay, so Amazon, let's leave the tech component out for a second. Right? And say this, right? So I spent the first 5-6 years of my time in New York studying media ownership and concentration trends. And the fundamental argument there, regardless of where you fall in terms of opinion or policy, is in order for a democracy to work properly, people need to have access to a broad range of news and information services. That's sort of the gist of it, right? It's like, so if I am in a local market, I have one cable TV channel or provider, I have only one newspaper, one radio station, and it's all owned by one person or one company, like I'm going to know nothing, right? And so, and that's the fear that we would not have a functioning democracy without diversity of access and so on. So you could make a similar argument that like the health of society is directly related to the ability of people to have a good time, to play, to socialize online and express themselves creatively in all these online environments, whether that's Call of Duty or Candy Crush or whatever else it is that floats your boat, right?
I mean, maybe part of the issue here is that we are talking about consolidation in the console market dominantly, right? Which is already the second largest of the sectors. Right. Mm-hmm. So games as an industry has so many different pockets, right? There's mobile, there's PC, there's console. We're talking about a subset of concern. And yeah, this is a big chunk of that subset. It has the ability to produce monopolistic behavior in one sector of games, but like games as a whole, I don't know. Maybe I'm not thinking about this the right way.
Look, at the end of the day, like this is supposed to be fun, right? And this is you could like, as much as I will be saying to you, oh, this is important, blah, blah, blah. It's also like, yeah, but it's also games. Let's not take ourselves too seriously. I think the fundamental difference perhaps that you and I have compared to say the FTC and the CMA is that like, we don't see that universe of gaming as purely two console companies.
Yeah, it's like, right? My gaming diet is so diverse and so spread across so many different platforms that the idea that Microsoft owning Activision somehow impedes my ability to find and play interesting, accessible, affordable games does not feel like an actual threat to me.
Okay, so welcome to the team. It's a there you go.
It's just a matter of definition. It's a different conversation about whether or not I think companies should get bigger, right? But this that is standard capitalist behavior. And, yeah. You know.
Yeah. No. So. But that's the summarized version. It's a phrase I stole from a professor I used to work for. You know. And it's the fish got bigger, but so did the pond. And there's new fish and there's new ponds. And so for the CMA and the FTC to look at gaming purely as Sony versus Microsoft around one goddamn title that I haven't played in years, it's like, okay, look, that can't be the thing that drives everything. You have to take so much more to consideration, you know? And I think that is kind of that's why I wrote those things, because it felt like it was such a narrow definition of gaming that has changed so much more, which is why the title is Bigger Means Different. Like it's not the same it was 10 years ago. Tencent wasn't around in a meaningful way 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, games as a creative industry is so good at mushrooming itself, right? Just kind of popping up in new areas, developing new things. It's, you know, games are most innovative forms of software experimentation. And so to this effect, you're correct. Like the idea that somehow all game experience is going to get subsumed between Sony and Microsoft is a very strange idea to me, at least, right? When like a huge portion of my gaming doesn't even touch either of those companies. You know, I fired up my Xbox for the first time to play a game a couple days ago in months, right? Mm-hmm. Which we can talk about.
You don't have children. So
I don't have children.
Yeah, you know, so you actually have time for all this.
Barely. Yeah.
Will you be putting up consoles and game stations during the Christmas party?
No, I'm just going to use my Xbox to broadcast a YouTube fireplace scene. So
okay. Well, I guess it will be a little bit part of the thing.
Yeah.
Cool. So look, if you want to know more, go read the thing I wrote. And like it's a, and I don't say that to promote myself, but to say that this is a landmark transaction that we're going to be talking right about this, whether you like it or not, for years. Same as with like AOL Time Warner, whether the outcome is good or bad, is that like these are defining moments. AT&T divestiture in the 80s, same thing. And so this is just a key moment in an industry. It speaks to so many aspects of the games industry at large. If you're interested in any of this, like this should, you should at least know the basics of this, right?
Yost, so where can listeners find your paper?
I have a Substack, superyost.substack.com. It's right at the top right now.
Right. Awesome.
Okay, now for the inevitable highlights, pones and owns. You want to go first?
I just have an own this week. I finally got time to play a game. I listened to the Twitter scuttlebutt and I decided to try Obsidian's new game out on Xbox Game Pass, Pentiment. And Pentiment is such a strange and interesting game. It's a point-and-click adventure at its base, but one that obviously has certain kind of RPG feeling qualities to it. It's set in like the 16th century. You're a manuscript illustrator working at a monastery, and a sort of, I can't quite tell if a mystery is about to unfold, but definitely political tensions arise and you're trying to build relationships with all the people in the town and as well as all of these monks and the nuns who live at the monastery. It does a very good job of kind of getting you into the intrigue of what's happening pretty quickly and you can't quite figure out how the choices you're making are exactly going to impact your future, which is part of what feels really fun about it.
Interesting.
That's so beautiful, dorky. Beautiful. It's very beautiful illustration style. Super weird. It's a weird game. And to see a weird game like that kind of blow up a bit is pretty nice, you know?
Which, by the way, you know, as an indie style, weird game, free on Game Pass, I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying, like, there you go, right? So it all comes together.
Would we consider a game published by Obsidian, an indie game? That's
whatever, like the, yeah. It's a deviant art style.
Yes, it is definitely a deviant sort of, yeah, it's a deviant game for sure.
It's I think that's wonderful. I think it's well deserved.
Yeah, it has a real sense of personality to it as a game, you know.
Right, they're gonna do more, right? There's a,
I'm not certain. Oh, the other own I would give is the announcement about Hades 2.
That was
met to great acclaim on the internet. Everyone is excited about Hades 2, which is just
kidding?
The best, absolute best, maybe ever, you know? Mm-hmm. So real, especially just a real intertwining of mechanic and narrative, you know, just a masterclass in that form. But
every time it comes up, I just want to go stop my day and go home and play. It's true. It's beautiful.
What's your pwn, Yost?
You know, I want to go with the Christmas cheer, the holiday cheer, and say I have an own.
Oh,
which is, you know, I mean, I guess you can cut it both ways, but you know, as I've mentioned before, I'm not a huge stick and ball sports person myself, but I have no filter for the World Cup in spite of everything, in spite of not knowing a lot of stuff, in spite of all the slave labor that went into it. It's like, it's just ridiculous, and yet here I am, just totally enamored. So as you've seen over the last few weeks, I have a dedicated screen in my office. I'm so happy that we're almost at the end because I need to get my life back on track. One of the most amazing stories was, you know, the run, this what they call the Cinderella run for the Moroccan team.
Yes.
Right? Which is not just, oh, they got lucky, this North African country. It's like, no, they've been diligently building a talent scouting system and a training, you know, business around it. So like, how do we identify and just cultivate this talent in this country, because they're incredibly talented players. There's just, there's no infrastructure to like onboard them into like the larger global soccer scene. I think that that speaks to a few things. First, that's the same thing that you see in the US where like small local teams like need to be supported more because otherwise you have no farm, no pool to draw from on the high levels. But it's also just like there's the Moroccan diaspora throughout Europe. Growing up, you know, you have like this just like neighborhoods of people that are, you know, third and fourth generation migrants, but they stay very insulated in some ways for all these reasons, some of them terrible. And then to see that sort of self-esteem boost over the last few weeks just rise, you know, it's just, and it's not just, you know, the Netherlands where I'm from, it's also in France and Germany, it's like everywhere. And it's just like, it was an amazing run. You know, beating France, that's a big ticket for everyone. I don't know if Messi with Argentina is even going to be able to do it in the final, but suffice to say, like Morocco really made itself heard. And I just thought that was one of the most invigorating narratives in soccer history that I've watched for a long time. And I'm still just riveting with it. Like, it's just an amazing thing for to see a country really kind of like manifest and then get the support of everybody in the Middle East. And so it's really, really been fun to watch that. And I think that that's what it should be all about. Like, it's really about profiling and like getting yourself out there and like being recognized for what you can do. So that's my own. I'll stop there. But it's like, that's been an amazing thing to just experience it in non-video gaming, but playful manner.
Yeah, it has been a big enough deal that it has ambiently filtered into my Instagram and my Twitter. And so even I am forced to know about what's going on at the World Cup. So
welcome. Yeah. I feel a lot of conversions between our interests this week. I feel like we're going to end up, you know, becoming friends at some point.
Oh, okay. That's how we're going to play this. All right. Well, everyone, we'll be wrapping our season next week with our last episode, recapping our classes and talking about if we can squeak any more game industry news out of this year. Anyway, join us then. Talk to you soon. Good night and good game.